Hey everyone, Stitcher is smart radio, on-demand news, talk, and more for your mobile phone. Stitcher brings radio and podcast listeners a better way to listen to their favorite shows and helps them discover new content by delivering personalized audio streams on demand right to your smartphone. Got Stitcher? We're on it, so get it! Stitcher is an award-winning provider of news, talk, and radio for your mobile phone. Stitcher Smart Radio, the smarter way to listen to radio. Let's get down!
Did I get here? And now here is your host, Tommy Holly.
Alright. Hi there. It's Johnny. I'm your host. I am I'm kind of suffering from allergies. They've been driving me crazy last couple of days, man. I'm out of it. I'm kind of my voice is messed up. I got a show tonight, solo show. I might take a whole bunch of stuff, maybe before I play, shock my system, freak out, you know, and I'm going to go stay with my dogs starting today too. So I'm kind of getting my stuff together, packing up. Got a show tonight, Hotel Vegas with John Leffler. I don't know if you're hearing this tonight. It's September 28, 2012, in Austin at Hotel Vegas. Exciting things that happened this week. I went to go see the Go-Go's with my friend Sandy. And we had a really good time. The show was really good. And it's funny because in this interview that you're about to hear with my friend CJ Erickson, who's very, very cool, we've been trying to get this interview going for a long time. Anyway, at the Go-Go show, they were amazing, as always. My friend Kathy is out with a busted wrist, although she was there and got up and played a song with them. Another person that I know from songwriting time in Los Angeles is Abby Travis, who was the bass player, and it was cool. Got to kind of catch up with her and catch up with Jane. But they played Call Me Maybe. So that was weird because, you know, just the day before, I'd done this interview with CJ Erickson, and we had spent some time talking about that song. So in summation, the Go-Go's concert, amazing. It was great. It was great to see them. They sounded great. They played great. I wish I would have gotten to talk to Charlotte a little bit. I did get to give her a big hug, and then she was gone. Zippity-doo-dah. Another cute thing was Jane packing up a lot of celery from the deli tray to take with her wherever it was she was going. I don't know, maybe on the bus. Maybe she went on the bus and took her celery and was happy. But I ended up going out afterwards, my friend Sandy and I, and I hadn't eaten dinner, and we were running around downtown and having cocktails, and I had to actually split like a phantom exit without saying goodbye to anyone. I just left because I didn't eat dinner, and I just started to feel like, ugh, I feel gross. I need to get home. So I went home, cabbed it, and now here I am. Anyway, dying of allergies. Hopefully they'll get better by the time the show tonight, and that's it. There you go. That's my intro for today. I'm out of it. I have allergies. It's Friday morning. You're going to listen to this, and you're going to go, God, poor guy. It's crazy. My guest today is Austin-based music producer, engineer, mixer, writer, CJ Erickson. He's a really great guy. We've been talking about doing this for a long time, months, since South by Southwest. And we finally got it together. He came over the other day. We hung out. We did it. And I saw him later on at the W and talked to him a little bit there. But it was great to have him over. It was great to get his perspective on music and kind of hear his story and where he came from and following the dream and what it's like to be a big-time producer, engineer, mixer whose discography includes U2, Matchbox 20, Rocket Summer, Fastball, Hoobastank, Fish, Hanson, Blue October, Incubus, and many, many more. So without further ado, here is my guest, the very cool, extremely talented CJ Erickson.
Thank you.
I'm going to ask you a question. And this question is, you're sensitive? Are you like a sensitive ear guy?
Not too bad.
No? They're in good shape?
They're okay.
Yeah.
I hope.
So, was you two there when you were mixing that? Bono and Edge?
Well, mixing with you two is a whole different thing. Mixing with them is, they almost go backwards. They have their own unique way of working. It's, you kind of mix a song and then they write it, basically.
You mix a track?
Yeah, you're in a constant state of mixing with them. You're just mixing. You're taking whatever they have and making it as great as it can be, literally daily, so they can come in and tear the song apart and rewrite it and fix it and get it better and better. I mean, they have this drive to make everything as amazing as it can be that they just can't stop. They're just constantly, okay, what could be better? What could be, you know, just working on the song endlessly, really.
So take a song like that. How long did you work on that song from when they first gave it to you to when you gave it to mastering?
I came in, they worked on the record, I think, for 2 years. And I came in on the last 2 months just to mix.
Right.
And with Steve Lillywhite. Steve Lillywhite, he's one of their longtime producers. He brought me in on the album. And you're basically assigned a song each day. You're kind of like, okay, you work, you know, different guys like Danny Lanois in one room, Brian Eno's in another room.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, we're all, I would be in a room sometimes with Steve, sometimes with myself. It's just every day you're working on something different. And that song in particular was, you know, they recorded it and then I think they weren't happy. Then they did it again, actually with Will.i.am.
Yeah.
And then they still just wanted to keep working on it. So then Steve and I got it and then we started again almost from scratch. A couple of things stayed. But literally, you'll work, you know, one day you'll just go and Bono will throw down 100 vocal things. Edge will come in and do a whole bunch of stuff. Larry will redo his drums, Adam do bass. And then by the end of the day, it's like, all right, this is great. Then the next morning, this is horrible. Let's redo this. And you're just, so literally, you know, weeks and 2 months of just on and off working on that song to literally, I can remember the last day, because we had to get done. The record basically is like when, you know, Jimmy Iovine's the label guy. He says, okay,
it's coming, the record out, like, has
to
next
be done.
Tuesday.
Yeah, the record has to be done like tomorrow. It was right before Christmas. We were in London. And I can remember it was about 6:30 in the morning. The mastering was getting done about 10.
Yeah.
About 6 or maybe even 7 in the morning. And we're still punching in, like, I remember the line, one of the last lines of the song. And literally, we just punch in this one line. Bono changes the lyric. And then it's like, all right, we're done. And, you know, Bono busts out some champagne and we're just sipping. And literally, I kind of finished the mix right then.
Yeah.
And I went to the hotel for maybe an hour and slept, got up. And, you know, I went to mastering. Edge was at mastering. And it was like, oh, we want to do one little change. So I'm sent back to the studio from mastering, mix a song again, go back to the mastering studio. And they, you know, they master that song. I mean, it's chaos. It's the most incredible experience ever working with those guys, but it's complete chaos. And that's just what works for them. That's how they roll.
But they know what's going on the whole time. It's not like that everything's completely out of control for them. It's just chaotic for the people working for them because they have some kind of vision that they're.
Well, to a degree. I mean, again, they're in this constant quest in everything I've worked with them with is a constant quest to just be the most amazing band. Like they want to make sure they deserve to be where they're at. I mean, they work harder than any band ever. And they don't have to. They don't have to do anything. But they really work harder and just try harder than any band I've ever worked with.
That's amazing.
Incredible. But it is chaos. I mean, it's chaos for everybody.
And how much have you worked with them?
I did that on the, you know, I ended up doing, three songs tracked and mixed on the last album. And then, a while later I got a call from Larry, the drummer, and I went to Dublin just with him and I, and I kind of worked with him for a few months just doing kind of drums and stuff. Like, the band's always writing. They were writing, and, you know, Larry doesn't want to always just be in the studio with Bono and Ed, so him and I would get together and just do drums and stuff for the new songs, right. or we did this thing where he would just track hours and hours of drums, and I would go through and literally, I mean, it'd take me a long time. I'd go through and kind of almost make songs out of his drums and, you know, just turn them in, you know, verse, chorus, bridge, and just kind of create these kind of 2 or 3 minute songs, basically of drum tracks. And, you know, I might add percussion, program some stuff. And then, you know, I make a whole bunch of these and those get given to Bono and Edge and they use them either to write with, or, you know, they might have a song they're working on and, oh, here's a perfect drum beat for that. Or maybe it's an inspiration for a new riff or something, you know, who knows? It's just Larry's way, one of Larry's way of just being a part of everything, you know.
Wow. You know, are they working on a new album now?
Yeah, they've been working on it for a long years. Time. Yeah. And then I went, and then shortly after that, that was mostly, geez, I guess, 2010, I spent a lot of, with doing this, and that, you know, I was in Dublin, then I did it here at home in Austin, and then a while later, I wasn't sure, I finished a bunch, I wasn't sure if I'd hear from them, and then I just get this random call, and, you know, they're on tour, and the guy who mixes for Larry and Adam on tour, their ears, was retiring after 30 years, and they wanted me to do it. Larry wanted me to mix, and I've never done anything like that whatsoever, but wow. You know, I'm not going to say no to those guys. So literally the next day I'm on a plane to, like, the conversation was, okay, do you want to do this? You have an hour to decide. It'll be about the next year. okay, I'll call you back in an hour. And, you know, I just kind of gave it a thought, talked to my manager, and then it was like, of course, I can't say no to this. And literally within, I mean, I don't know if it's the next day or days, I'm off to Australia and spent the next eight months, yeah, just touring the world, yeah.
Wow.
It's incredible.
What's it like seeing them every night like that?
I mean, incredible. I mean, it's, you know, literally.
They change the set list a lot?
Little bits here and there to a degree. I mean, it's such a machine, their show. I mean, there's such, you know, I don't know if you went to 360.
Like the biggest show in the world. Yeah.
It was literally the biggest tour ever in the world. I mean, just the amount of insanity that goes on with the stage show, the lights, everything. I mean, they really can't, you know, it's kind of like changing a song. The set is like turning the Titanic. You know, you can't.
Yeah.
You can't really do that.
Yeah, there's like lights
easy.
And like
everything.
Flying monkeys.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's, I mean, there's a few spots, you know, because a lot of shows we do maybe two or three nights in one city. So there'd be altered. There's a few slots where we're changed and then some that kind of stay the same all the time, you know.
They also, from watching the documentary that came out with the Octoon Baby.
You know, the about? Recent one from the Sky
Down?
Yeah. They were filming that while we were on tour, yeah.
They, the amount of like self-abuse after a show that goes on between those guys is almost saddening. There's so many, you know.
Well, it's because they care. I mean,
they really do.
I mean, literally up to the last, 2 weeks of a 3-year tour, they're still up there rehearsing and practicing and tweaking the set. And I mean, there's 2 weeks left of this tour and they're still just working so hard. I mean, the preparation that went into doing the Glastonbury Festival.
Yeah.
I mean, that was like months of just finding the perfect set, just making sure. I mean, it's incredible how hard these guys work. It really blows my mind.
Wow. So that's your work with you two. CJ Erickson, that's your name. What does it stand for, CJ? Do you mind saying it?
Chadwick Joseph Erickson.
Oh, that's awesome. You're the second Chadwick I know.
Really?
Uh-huh. I know this other guy named Chadwick. He's nice. it's a perfectly good name.
It's a little pompous. You know?
Where are you from?
Canada, Vancouver, Canada.
And What was your, like, how long did you live in Canada?
Well, born and raised in Vancouver till I was about, I guess, 18. And I just, you know, I did music my whole life. I was played in orchestras, violin, for most of my childhood and toured in Western Canada, just kind of playing in schools and whatnot. And then, also guitar and piano lessons, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, music was always everything. And when I was a teenager, I would start playing the drums. I went to rock, you know, AC/DC, that kind of stuff. And I just knew music was all I did, all I had, all I was ever going to do. And I knew I had to go to Los Angeles. That was my, you know, got to go to LA and just be, you know, in the music business. And obviously I was a musician first. I wanted to be, I guess, a rock star or whatever.
Yeah,
but, you know, I always had this interest in the studio side. I took
your whole life.
Yeah. I mean, I dropped out of high school early and I took an actual recording school up in Canada. And just because I just wanted to learn all aspects of the business and how records are made, music is made, all that stuff, you know.
And so did you go to LA hoping to make be in like the technical side of making records, like producing and engineering
to be a rock star, you know?
Yeah,
to just, that was definitely the main goal. And then basically my day job kind of turned into making records.
So what how did you were your parents behind you? Were they like, yeah, go to LA, this is it? I mean, obviously, if you're playing all those instruments and stuff, they must have been somewhat supportive.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, I was on my own, you know, there was nothing nobody could do or say to influence me. You know, I was on a mission. Literally since age 5, I could read music before I could read English. I mean, I've just, music's been my whole life. I mean, I literally can't do anything else.
I have that conversation with a lot of people sitting here. Like, what do you do, like, at this point in our lives? Yeah, like, if it's time to change, like, it's not like I'm going to wake up tomorrow and be a lawyer.
Right. I'm an excellent driver. You know, I've never been in a car accident. I'll knock on wood.
That's good. That's good. So when you went to LA, did you get in bands, or what was it like moving from Vancouver, Canada to LA? How, I mean, was it a culture shock beyond your wildest dreams? You don't need to wear those if you don't want.
Oh, that's okay.
Okay.
It was one of those things. I went when I was 18 years old, and the first time stayed about 6 months, and it was hard. I mean, I was, you know, not that I like to say this, but I was illegal. I'm a Canadian illegal.
Yeah.
And I had very little money, went there and just kind of saw it. And after 6 months, I had to stop for a little while and went back to Canada. And I literally spent a year and a half on the road in a cover band in Canada where you could make a really good living and just toured all over, just playing the drums, playing the 350.
So that's what you were playing drums.
Yeah.
Drums was
kind of my main thing. Okay. For some reason, I just thought, once I became a teenager, I thought, you know, violin, piano, all this sissy stuff, you know, I want to rock, you know.
And
I went to the drums. So I did that, and it helped me really get good.
What kind of cover band?
Like what was just the, rock.
Just top
I mean,
40
yeah. I mean, we do everything from like Guns N' Roses to CCR to whatever. I mean, it was, you know, this is 1989, 88, 89.
Okay, yeah.
You know,
maybe a little U2, probably. Right?
Possibly.
Yeah.
Yeah. We might have been more rock than that.
Yeah.
Actually. Yeah.
Okay. But, so when you went back, what did you do when you were there first though illegally? You just couldn't get it.
Get
traction.
Yeah, and I went down with a friend, and we were trying to get something going, and it just, you know, it was just hard, and I kind of ran out of money, and wasn't really sure what to do, and so, like I said, I went back, and I got good at playing for touring like that. I think that's the only way you really get good is playing every night like that.
Yeah, and then you guys play long shows like we do in Skyrocket,
exactly.
Like long.
Exactly,
That really does make you, because if anything, you know, even if you're not practicing, you're still playing 3 hours a day.
Yeah, you know? You're playing your A game. I mean, you're up there on stage. You know, you can only rehearse so much and get good so much.
Yeah.
When you're in front of people, something kicks in where you're really going that extra mile. But so then I moved back when I was 20. So this I've been 1990, I guess. And I had about maybe a couple grand, still legal. And just literally, I kind of went down and I was in this little band for a while and just kind of started going for it. And I did get briefly, I would get little jobs.
What was this scene when you went back there? Was it kind of like the end of the Sunset hair metal scene?
Yeah.
And the beginning of...
Well, there were like some of the big, like Jane's Addiction was just exploding then. And it was definitely a little bit the alternative side.
Right.
And I was, you know, I was just this, you know, young Canadian kid, maybe a little depressed. And I kind of got into the, you know, I don't want to do labels so much, but the goth scene a little, you know.
That's cool.
I was definitely a dark boy, and you know, and we just kind of in that whole kind of underground dark thing, you know, again, Jane's Addiction, bands like that were a part of that kind of stuff back then. And then I ended up joining this band called Human Drama, which is again kind of in this dark wave thing, and we had to deal with XXX Records, who also where Jane's Addiction came
didn't
from.
Didn't we have this conversation about that band?
Maybe.
No.
Maybe. We might have.
No, I'm thinking of a different person.
Right.
There was a band once that somebody asked me to join them, but it wasn't that. Sorry, go ahead.
Right. But yeah, so I mean, I spent years, probably 6-7 years, I bet, with that band, just touring the world, and we made a lot of records, and that's kind of how I started getting to the studio side, because I had this interest, and we would get these, you know, our record budget was, say, $5,000 to do a whole record, and we go to the studio in Santa Monica, where I kind of came out of 4th Street Recording, and... you know, they literally give them the whole budget and they give us a bunch of days in the studio. And then they were so cool. They would go, hey, after midnight when the studio's closed, you guys can just go in there whenever you want. But unless you want to pay for someone to, you know, engineer or whatever, then, you know, you got to do it yourself. So it was more like, well, hey, I kind of know this. So that's kind of where I got my start making records on my own records, is engineering and producing those. And you know, after a year or two of that, the studio owner's just kind of like, well, geez, you work here more than anyone. Do you want a job? And like, boom, I got a job at a studio, you know.
How much did you learn in school that applied? Just some?
Nothing.
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 Did you ever have like a 4-track and record at home all the time? Yeah.
Yeah. I was that guy.
I always feel like that's the stuff that prepares, because I went to school for it too, and I didn't learn anything that I didn't learn on my Tascam Border 1.
It's hands-on that really does
totally,
everything. For sure.
Totally. So you toured with that band 6 years?
Yeah, probably 6-7 years, and we did, probably 4 or 5 records at least. You know, went all over. I mean, for some reason, we were huge in Mexico. We'd go to Mexico City and we're massive there. It was incredible. And Europe. And then, you know, we had bigger markets in the States where we did really well. I mean, we'd go to the New York mid-90s playing like the Limelight. You know, we'd sell it out 12, 1500 people kind of thing. I mean, we were a good underground kind of thing. You know, it was a lot of fun. Learned a lot. You know,
that's really awesome. What was the Limelight like? Because I went by there the Friday. And it's
a market.
It's like a market.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It's no, like it's a weird indoor mall or something. Yeah,
it was a great club. In.
Yeah.
Really cool. Just vibe. I mean, again, it was that dark, you know, almost like a castle inside or something.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
Really cool. But all these chambers, all these different rooms. And, you know, it was a cool vibe.
So at the end of that, you start working in this studio and just kind of like house engineer, whatever band's coming in, you're doing it.
Yeah. Just lots of different stuff. Just, you know, for a couple of years just doing that. And that was literally, you know, my day job. And then, you know.
Did you do anyone that went on to greatness?
Well, I mean, that's kind of how then things got kickstarted is there's a, you know, sometimes guys will get jobs at studios to get free studio time. And one of the kids that got a job as a janitor there was this guy, Mikey, who's, you might know him as Mike, the guitar player from Incubus.
Oh, wow.
And so he was 17 years old, probably 16 years old, and he got a job at the studio to get free studio time for his band, Incubus. And they were all just young guys, and they recorded the same like kind of thing I did with my band. They would record in the off hours, and the owner of the studio would help them out, and all those songs ended up becoming released later.
Incubus, right?
Well, the EPs, Enjoy Incubus and stuff like that, they released after the fact. And eventually they got a record deal, and then I did their first record. The owner of the studio, he just said, well, look, you know, I want to kind of be a producer. I want you to engineer for me. He's like, okay, great. And so our first major record was Incubus when they got their deal and the Science album. And, you know, back then even, you know, you just knew they were going to explode. I mean, Brandon was a rock star. Mike was you know, he was way ahead of his years in talent and everything. I mean, you just knew there was something amazing. And that was kind of my first like real major label album, and it turned into to this day. I mean, I still have so many Incubus fans coming up to me just, man, that's my favorite record of everything they've ever done. And it didn't sell as much as anything else, but it's definitely like a, for fans, a, you know,
it's a good,
you know, they're excited about that one.
And then what'd you go on to after that?
Well, and then shortly after that,
well, once you have like one successful major label record, then...
Well, that one didn't get too, I mean, they had to slog it out for a while. I mean, they started taking off. They went out, like they were going tour with Korn and bands like that, and I think even Rage Against the Machine, stuff like that.
They
started taking off a little bit, but not in a huge way. And in the meantime, I got into another band, this new band. We were called Jacked, and it was kind of a British pop sort of, you know, we were in the Verve Oasis-y thing, and we ended up getting a record deal.
Oh, cool.
And we were with Trauma Records, and which had Bush and No Doubt and stuff. So we put a record out and toured with Bush for a while, and you know, it was incredible. We had a, you know, top 20 single. I mean, the record never sold, but for some reason we had a couple
songs
on the radio that did well briefly. But it just, you know, our singer, he was a massive junkie, everything. He's dead now, actually. Lovely guy. I miss him to death. But it's so sad. He's such a talent. And the label was falling apart, and we were falling apart, and it just kind of all... I can remember literally being on the road with Bush, and just we're about to play, like, some big show, you know, just, I mean, they were obviously all great shows with Bush back then. Yeah. And I can remember just looking around, just knowing it was about to all end, and just like, okay, just enjoy this, because this might be, you know, I was 30. It's like, this might be it for my rock star days,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah,
so
yeah.
At least I got this. This is awesome. Take it in, you know? And then I was right. I mean, it all just kind of fell apart. But over the years, I kind of quit making records during that year or two time. And there was a band Incubus had friends with. I remember one day they're coming in like, hey, we got this band in the neighborhood. They're called Hoobastank, some new guys.
Right.
And you guys should work with them. It's like, okay, great. So over those few years, I mean, it took a good 2 or 3 years of doing demos and demos and demos and really in every label turning them down and every, you know, just couldn't get anywhere until they finally just wrote those few songs. Like when I got back to records after the band broke up, they wrote those few songs that finally labels went, okay, that's the ones we've been waiting for. And they, you know, they got a deal. It was, you know, songs like Crawling in the Dark and Running Away, which ended up being their first record, so we ended up doing the first record, which was that album. Their first one went platinum. And that was probably my first big proper record.
What year was that? Like 2001?
2001. Yeah, probably 2001.
Yeah.
So 99, I think, was when the band Jack came out. And then I just, as soon as that was done, it's like, okay, forget the rock star stuff. It's, you know, the studio stuff is going to be where I'm going. You know, I love it.
Yeah.
So it was awesome that it just parlayed into that, you know?
Yeah.
And then,
so where did you go? What did you do after Hoobastank?
Well, I mean, you know, once
that's all started falling in.
Exactly. Once you have some big records, I mean, then people just start calling you. I mean, people look at the credits, which they don't get to do anymore, which is so bad. I mean, no one knows who does any records anymore, but back then, you know, people would have CDs or cassettes or whatever and go, well, I love how this record sounds, or I like how this production is. And they can look in the liner notes and go, oh, that guy. And, And, you know, next thing you know, people are, you know, calling your management. And, you know, I can remember, you know, that time our, you know, our manager would come in and like a stack of CDs of bands, all signed bands, all bands you'd heard of. And just like, hey, all these guys are looking for producers and stuff. You know, who do you want to work with? And you'd just be looking through all these stacks of CDs like, no, no. Oh, I kind of like these guys. No, no, no. And, you know, it's just so different than it is now.
Yeah.
You know, but and then so what I did a bunch of stuff. I mean, you know, I was still engineering with this other guy and producing as well on the side with my own stuff. And we did like bands like Something Corporate, which turned into Jack's Mannequin, which is a great little pop thing. I mean, it's
let me ask you this, as far as like you're saying, like, I know that weird sort of there's no more credits or anything like this. And also, when I downloaded the songs that you sent me, I played them. They started playing in my iTunes, opened it up, but I didn't have anything plugged into my computer and it came on the speakers. And the first thing I thought is like, man, nowadays as a mixing guy, when you're doing a big record, there's the old times when you do the R-Tone or you go out and listen to the mix in the car. Do you listen to it on like a fucking laptop just to see how does it sound on these speakers? You have to, right?
Or my little iHome thing is one of my good references, which actually sounds pretty good. That or the laptop. I mean, you want to make sure you hear the bass on the laptop, you know, because there's no bass frequencies in the lap. So if you can hear it in the laptop, then okay, I'm doing pretty good, you know.
And do you shrink them to MP3s and see what that sounds like? And
For some reason, I refuse MP3s. I only go to MP4s.
Right.
Whatever that means, you know. But
do you notice the difference between all that? Like, can you hear the difference between all the mediums?
At the end of the day, you know, and I tell bands this all the time because, you know, you get guys who just, we have to record on tape. We got to get this sound. It's like, dude, you know, really, by the time it's shrunk down and people are listening through their little crappy iBuds and listening through their laptop, yeah, it's all the same. It doesn't matter. No, and that's the thing with music is music fans, any kids that are at home or adults, whatever, you know, no one's listening and going, oh, I would love this song if just that guitar tone was a little bit better. You know, no one cares. You know, I mean, songs are about, music is about feeling and emotion and passion. No one really cares about how it sounds, which it's sad, but it's true. I mean, you know, no one really cares about if it's done on tape or if it's this or that. And especially when they're listening on their laptop or their earbuds, it's that feeling. It's that relating to their life feeling or whatever that, I mean, that you and I, whatever, growing up, you know, you can think of listening to headphones as a kid and just, you know, listening to lyrics and listening to songs, just like, well, that's my life. That's how I feel. I mean, that's what people care about with music. It's not how it sounds. So again, it's kind of sucks because everything in the world, I mean, HDTV, Blu-rays, everything, all other mediums seem to be getting better. Music's getting worse. It makes no sense, but it's just how it is.
Yeah. Do you fear the future of music business? Obviously it's got you've obviously got a good thing going on. You're right, but you're only one bad record away from
Yeah, exactly. I mean, you know, it seems the more success I get, the more I still have to hustle and work harder. And you know, you're really only as good as your last hit record in this business. It has shrunk so bad, you get big producers who in the old days would only work with the big bands, but now they want to work with the young bands and new bands because it's not that many big budget records anymore. So now all of a sudden I'm competing with, you know, big, huge producers on some new band or something, which obviously you're not going to win those battles. And so it's definitely shrunk and it's harder. And I definitely have to work harder, it seems. But, I can't, you know, so many people talk about the doomsday music, but I really, truly, music's never going to end. I mean, people need music. They have to. It's just a matter of figuring out how to just make a living off it still and how to just keep going and the strong will survive, you know. I mean, I got nothing else to do. I got nothing else I can do in life.
Right.
I can't stop now, you know. Yeah. So you just find ways to keep it going.
Yeah. And you seem to have done that.
I mean, I'm trying.
Yeah. I'm sure it might have been a little weird you had to make when you were offered the position doing that U2 tour.
Yeah.
That you're going to miss out on a lot of records during that time kind of running live.
Yeah. And I did. And I'm kind of in that right now where because this is the first year last year that don't have a whole bunch of records coming out because I spent literally 2 years with U2 doing stuff, with stuff that's not come out or on tour or just, you know, songwriting, helping with their songwriting demos and stuff. So, you know, it is a little strange, but obviously I couldn't say no to those guys. I mean, it's amazing. It's, you know,
You won't really get to work with a lot of bands like that.
Yeah.
There aren't any bands like that.
Exactly.
Because I'm sure even like working with like the only other bands like Aerosmith, and they just seem real watered down.
Sure.
And the Stones would be weird.
Yeah, yeah, right. Yeah, I mean, U2 is...
It's like the last band.
Yeah.
Of, you know, superheroes. Okay, yeah. So you did more records there in L.A. You were producing and stuff in the mid-2000s and mixing and stuff there?
Yeah, I kind of do it all. I mean, I'm kind of lucky where I can do it all. I mean, my goal of what everything I do is just to be the one-stop shop, especially with budgets shrinking now, just be the producer, engineer, mixer. Yeah. All you need is me, you know, and I help bands writing as well. But I'm fortunate where I can also, like, I got lucky hooking up with Steve Lillywhite, you know, we used to have the same manager and he's the kind of guy who likes to work with different people a lot. And he was looking for someone new to work with. And we had a couple mutual friends and I got recommended and boom, I got a call just to, like, hey, you're going to go do the Matchbox 20 record with Steve Lillywhite.
Gonna so you record were engineering?
Recording and mixing with Steve, yeah. And I met Steve the first day in the studio, actually, the first day on the record. We just met at the studio that day and with the band, and we just hit it off right away. And he's an incredible guy, and, you know, and obviously he's been around so long. I mean, he's amazing and just vibe and everything. I mean,
you learn a lot
so much. Oh, yeah.
In those situations.
Oh,
him.
And we just kind of, for some reason, we really worked well together.
How was Matchbox 20 to work with?
Awesome yeah, guys. Yeah,
they seem like a very focused cool. group of dudes.
Yeah, super, super cool. I mean, you know, all those guys are just so down to earth, so cool. I mean, Rob Thomas is, you know, one of the nicest guys I've worked with. I mean,
I've heard that a lot.
All those guys, Paul, everyone, you know, all those guys are amazing. Yeah.
So what did you do after the Matchbox 20 record? When did you move here?
Well,
and how did that happen? Why?
Let's see, I guess it was about 2006. Yeah, I've been here 6 years now. I just, you know, the whole time when I moved to LA, I was, you know, I wanted to go to LA for music, the business, whatever. But I always had this goal of possibly moving back to Vancouver or just whatever, somewhere else. I never really enjoyed LA. I mean, LA is a great place for work, for business, but just your day-to-day life, the traffic, just the shallowness, just everything there is just, I don't know. It just really got to me. And then I had a kid and it was like, you know, I just didn't want her to grow up there. And I was looking for somewhere else to move. I really didn't know. And I mean, I was even thinking Vegas or Palm Springs or just, I mean, anywhere, just somewhere out of LA. And also at the time, real estate in LA just completely skyrocketed out of control. And it got to the point where, like, geez, even if I could, you know, afford a place like this, why would I spend that much money for this? You know, I mean, it just got ridiculously overpriced. And I came out and did a record in Austin, and it was April. The weather was amazing. And I loved Austin. Yeah, I mean, I just fell in love with the city immediately. It's such a great music town and food. And, you know, I'm a vegetarian. It was real kind of vegetarian friendly. I mean, everything. And the weather was fantastic. And
so you thought.
Yeah. And then I looked at real estate. And it's like, are you kidding me? Like, you know, this is amazing. So I came here for a weekend to look at a house and bought a house that weekend.
What was the record you did here?
It was actually a friend of mine. New band. It's a friend of mine, this guy, Brian Jamel. The band was called Fascination 127. It's just, you know. He's kind of this guy. He's just a passionate music fan, and he's just kind of has this band. It's almost a hobby that he does. I mean, he does it, like, I mean, like, he'll rehearse every week, like a few times a week. But he's just kind of just does it for the love of doing it. And you know, he had enough money to kind of have us come out and do a record, and you know, just a good close friend.
And then so then you moved out here.
Yeah,
and
like a few months later, I just came out, bought a house, like, literally that weekend, and I didn't come out here for a while because I was working, but then it was amazing. I came, what is it, probably the 4th of July weekend to move here, and I can remember getting off the plane and just feeling this heat and like,
wait a minute,
what the heck is this? What is going?
Especially coming from Canada,
yeah,
and we're LA where it's just perfect.
Well, I think I was coming from Santa Barbara. I was doing the band live. I was doing their record in Santa Barbara at the time, so I took the weekend and flew here to move to my house and. So Santa Barbara's even a little cooler. It's like San Francisco, and that cold ocean breeze. And I'll never forget that feeling. Just it's like, who turned on the heater? What's going on?
It's horrible. Yeah. What was that like working with Live?
Oh, great, great. They're a great band.
And didn't you work on his solo album as well?
Yeah. I did the last two. I recorded the last two Live albums. And then at the tail end of their band, they're broken up now. Then they asked me to come and produce the last two songs they ever did as a band together. And I went to Chicago and did that. And then the band broke up. And then Ed, the singer, called me a while ago to do a solo record. And actually, that was one of the reasons I moved to Austin is, you know, with the budget shrinking, with the music business getting smaller, you know, I can make a record in Austin for, you know, a third, a quarter of the price as LA. So, you know, I talked him into coming out here to do the records. Like, dude, I can do a record so much cheaper, so much better. I got amazing musicians. And he, so he just completely put his trust in me. I'm like, don't worry. I got amazing guys. I'll put a band together, everything.
Who'd you get?
Anyone? Yeah. Well, there was this band Wide Awake who I was working with locally.
Yeah, I like those guys. And, they're nice.
I'd done their record and they're great friends. I mean, those are some of my best friends here still to this day. And,
Are they still a band?
No, Scott's up in Dallas now. Chris is still here, so I put Chris and James Gabby, were from Wide Awake, the guitar and bass player.
Right.
And then I had this drummer, Rami Antown, amazing drummer. I mean, he moved to Austin a few years back. He played with Seal, people like that. I mean, he's one of the best drummers I've ever worked with in my life. I mean, he's incredible. And had him come in and basically we did the record in 2 weeks with all those guys. Ed had never met the guys till the first day of the studio. And he just loved them all, ended up hiring them all, and they're still his band now. So
that's the last awesome.
2-3 years, they've been just touring the world with him and just loving life.
Wow. Does he have any plans to make a new record or anything?
I think he's doing an EP or something right now. But okay. And, you know, he's doing with someone else. But I've literally done everything he's done since, 2004 or something. So, yeah. You know, I can't expect to.
And you have a cool, you seem to have a cool disposition, or not one of those guys. I know a few guys that get really bent out of shape when
you can't worry.
It's all like, sometimes you want to do something new. Exactly. It's nothing against the guy.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, I came from the band, so I know that sometimes, opportunity to work with someone you love to work with.
Yeah.
You go for it, you know.
Yeah. So. A lot of people want to have that George Martin and Beatles thing where you're like the only guy that's been there the whole time.
Yeah.
So then, who else? Name some other guys that aren't. Like, what was it like working with Phish?
Oh,
that's a different kind of band.
Great. Yeah, I did that with Lily White. Those guys are so talented. I mean, musician wise, they've got to be the best band I've worked with. I mean, just everything was done mostly live. We did it in New York, which was incredible. It was one of my best record making experiences ever. 2 months in New York,
in the upstate? Or
no, in Manhattan.
In Manhattan,
Chung King down in the village, I guess, the West Village. It was just down, just Houston, Varick area there. But I always get this apartment when I'm there for a while, right on Bleecker Street, just in the heart of it all. And literally, I'd walk to work every day. It was incredible.
Awesome.
I love New York. I worked there a lot, and I don't know why I haven't moved there yet.
Studios there are small, aren't they?
I've only seen a couple
of them.
This was, Chung King was one of the major studios in town. Okay. They've actually closed and changed locations. I don't know what their new place is, but that was actually the reason they picked that studio, is because we were on maybe the 12th floor or something, and big window outside, like where I sat, I could just see the Empire State Building and everything. I mean, it was
awesome.
They just wanted a vibe and cool, and where, you know, they were out in the, you know, where the studio part was, big windows where it's just all of Manhattan. It was, you know, incredible views, and that's kind of what they were after, just a vibe, you know.
Yeah,
but that was an amazing record to do, and such nice guys. I mean, Trey's such a sweetheart. I mean,
They seem like really nice guys. We were label mates for a while, and I went to go see them shoot an Austin City Limits thing here. That was really good. But the guy that, the kind of rep from Elektra at that time, was telling me, like, the greatest guys.
Yeah.
I didn't get to meet him, though.
Yeah, just super regular, ordinary, just
intense fans, man.
Oh, yeah,
like,
yeah.
Really, like, you know, they picked up a lot of that kind of Grateful Dead wave of people that will do anything to be in the same room or, you know, at the festival with these guys.
Yeah. Yeah, I didn't even, you know, I'll admit, it's bad of me to say, but I had never really heard much Phish before I did the record.
Yeah,
I'm not from that thing.
I've never heard Phish on the radio.
Exactly. Yeah.
I mean, I don't know a Phish song, but I saw them and they were awesome.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah.
But they're, yes, extremely just rabid fan base. Extremely.
Yeah. I remember walking out of there. There was the whole area outside of, you know, that where it used to be on campus was just filled with just all these people with signs and shirts and.
Yeah. And they follow them around everywhere. Yeah, exactly. And they got those Grateful Dead thing that they follow them all around the country
everywhere.
And stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, that's amazing.
That's great.
What about Hanson? What did you do with them?
Great guys. I recorded and mixed, I guess, 2 records ago. It's called The Walk. Yeah. And that was a great experience. They're up in Tulsa, Oklahoma. And I spent, probably a good 4 or 5 months on and off going up there, you know, for 2-3 week, 4 week stretches at a time. And they had their own kind of compound with the studio and everything. I just stayed at, you know, I kind of had my own little living quarters and walked to the studio, and they have a big family. I mean, just great people. I mean, to this day, you know, there's some of my best friends. I mean, Taylor and I are just, you know, great friends. We keep in touch, and every time's in town, we're hanging out. I mean, they're just great guys.
Yeah.
Really great guys. And again, super talented.
Yeah.
Really talented.
Yeah.
You know, they
how are they doing now? I mean, is it that, you know, that's a different, it's a different world for them. Are they, are they probably pretty happy to be able to make music without the mbop, you know, thing happening all the time?
Well, that's kind of like,
they're all grown up now.
Yeah, they're all, I mean, Taylor's, I think he's on his fifth kid right now.
Wow.
You know, and but it's kind of a good and bad thing with them with mbop, because obviously it, you know, it opened up to the world and, you know, of course made him a bunch of money and stuff, but they've been kind of had this label with them since because of it. And it's horrible because they're an amazing band, so talented. But, you know, people just can't. I mean, there was actually,
like, if you mentioned Hanson to my sister, she would think of Three Little Kids.
Yeah.
Or,
but,
like, you know,
For this record, I mean, this is what was sucked is there was a station in Chicago with a big rock station. When the single came out that we did from that album, the Chicago station started playing it. Didn't say who it was. It wouldn't say who it was.
Yeah, yeah.
And for weeks, the song went to number one. It just, the most call-ins, most everything, everyone was freaking out. And then they finally said, hey, everyone, this is Hanson. And they got this huge backlash of people. This story actually made, there's a story in Rolling Stone magazine about this whole thing, how the people then just revolted and, oh, I don't want to hear that. I hate Hanson. It's like, well, what are you talking about? You loved them last week before you knew it was Hanson. And it was just, it's terrible, that
That's
kind
not
of
cool.
mentality. And, you know, it's because the thing with them is they have this, again, this huge little fan base that they can just tour the world and fill up big places, and they got their great little thing, and they're so happy doing that. I mean, they're in the perfect situation.
Yeah,
but it just kind of blows that this attitude that people have towards them like that. You know,
there's a lot of that kind of thing.
Yeah.
What did you do with Fastball?
I produced their last record.
Oh yeah.
What was it called?
The one with each of their picture on the front.
It was just a couple years ago.
Yeah. My friend Corey toured with them on bass.
Yeah, what the heck? I'm blanking on the name of the album. But great record. Those guys, super cool,
super cool guys.
Yeah,
huh?
I mean, I think they should be way bigger than they are. I mean, really.
That's another huge. It's weird, you know, because you're trying to get a hit. You know what I mean? And then you get it, and it kind of twists your shit around a little bit. Yeah. You don't have like a normal growth period.
Right. I mean, to me, Tony and Miles are like the Lennon and McCartney of America. I mean, they should be.
Yeah.
You know, the two of them together are great. I mean, just real songs, real, you know, that classic real songwriting kind of songs. I mean, I thought we made a great record. I'm really proud of that record.
Yeah. I'm good friends with both of those guys. And I think they're a lot better than they are getting credit for now.
Yes.
You know?
Yeah. It's too bad, really.
What about Blue October? What did you do with them?
I did that with Lily White, actually. We did that here in Austin. They're not the newest record. The one before had a couple hit with the song Dirt Room.
Yeah.
Say It. A couple great guys. I mean,
great
again,
guys.
Still good friends with all those guys and see them a lot. And you know, just great, talented, cool band. I mean, Justin.
I met you with kind of their crew of friends, right?
Probably
at South by Southwest. You were running around.
Yeah, probably. Yeah. I think so. Yeah, I mean, Matt lives real close. We hang out a lot. And I just saw Justin a couple weeks ago, or last week actually. Yeah.
Yeah. Have you seen Matt's new place? That's a good place.
The studio?
Yeah.
Oh, it's going to be incredible. Yeah. I went by the other day to look at it. It's a monstrosity.
It's amazing.
Yeah.
So what did you set up a mixing place at your house that you got here?
You know, I've kind of always been that guy who
you go somewhere else.
Yeah. I've never really wanted a studio. You know, I've never really wanted to be, I mean, I have a setup at home where I do, you know, writing, I can do overdubs, whatever, or mix setup. I mean, I just have a small, you know, Inbox 2 Pro sort of setup, enough where I can just do things. But I've just, to me, you know, a studio is like a money pit. You know, it's just every time you get here, then all of a sudden everything has to be upgraded and new stuff. And then, you know, it's just constant. I'd rather keep my money, you know, than spend it all like that.
Yeah. Yeah, so where do you go? Do you have a couple of different places?
Yeah, I mean, that's, again, one of the reasons of coming to Austin is there's great studios for a fraction of the price of L.A. I mean, I have this place that I work at a lot in Dripping Springs. It's a kind of a private studio of this woman's and of Gina. And, you know, she doesn't really allow a lot of people there. And so it's kind of my personal little mix room that I use. And so it's perfect because I my setup's always ready. I can go in there and work real quick and easy. And then I got, you know, The Wire, Perdinalis.
Right.
And well, now it's going to be Arlen Studios. There's a new studio, Austin Signal, up in BK. This guy, John, he's a great new studio. I mean, I have my little handful of places I go to.
Yeah.
Just depending on the budget, the vibe, whatever, or wherever the band wants to go. So,
right.
But again, just I can work so much more efficiently in this city than anywhere else.
I'm drawing a blank on the guy whose record comes out on Tuesday.
Oh, Michael McDermott, who's actually playing on the Saxon Puppies coming into town and doing a... little residency there starting this week. But yeah, that's a great record. This guy's, he's been around for a while, probably since the early 90s, and he had a little success back in the early 90s, and he's just kept on going for it. I mean, he's again going, you know, to like the fastball guys, just that classic songwriting. Just the guy's just got this voice and this writing that just is just the real deal, the real thing. I mean, I went up to, I prepped the record here. We kind of did it over the internet. Just, I kind of got tempos, arrangements. I did a lot of programming stuff and here at home. And then we went to, I went to Chicago where he's out of, and we literally did the record in 8 days. And I came back and mixed it in a couple of days here. And it's one of the my most proud records I've ever done. I mean, I think we just captured something. It just, cool. It's excellent. I'm really, I wish he had a, it's coming out on an indie label, which, I mean, of course I love all labels, but yeah. I just truly wish he gets the attention he deserves, because this I think the record's fantastic.
It seems sometimes though in this day and age, when there's a guy that, or a person that's more of like a songwriter thing, that almost they'll get the attention maybe a little more from a indie label than a lot of times. It just feels like the place where major labels are at right now is they, you know, they'll throw it against the wall, it doesn't stick. They have to move on to the next thing, because
You know,
there's the money flying out the door.
Yeah, and everyone's afraid to lose their jobs at this point, so they don't want to spend too much money. And
but it's weird because it seems like everyone's always been afraid of losing their jobs.
Yeah, but they're...
And those guys that, you know, I don't know. What do you think? You think that's good? I don't know. What do you think?
Right.
You
know a bit of that sheep mentality. You know, when, you know, no one likes something until they see one guy like it. It's like, okay, now I like it.
Yeah.
You know, but back in the day, I mean, to throw $1 million or $2 away, it was
if
no
you
big
lost
deal.
It was a good tax write-off.
Yeah, it was like, okay, whatever, that didn't work. And now, you know, that's why so many records now don't even get put out, because it costs $1 million to put out. So a band gets signed, they do a record, and if they don't think there's going to be that surefire hit, it's like, boom, we're not going to put this record out. You know, just from what I say, I mean, now it's, if you lose that $1 million, like, you're going to lose your job now. We're in the, back in the day, $1 million was the lunch budget for a couple weeks for a label, you know, the money that was being, I mean, it's good and bad. I mean, back then, obviously, it was great for me work-wise, but it was kind of the kind of excess and waste of money was terrible.
Well, it must also be kind of almost a mindfuck to go from a guy like Michael McDermott or something. Not that you went from this to that, but like, you know, to like a U2 sort of thing, where that's, you know, one of the last kind of bands that operates on that level of like, you know, come and record my drum things for as long as I ask you to.
Right. Yeah, I'll money's not really an object them.
Even now, it's so weird.
Yeah, but, you know, for me, at the end of the day, it's all about the music, man. I don't really care who it is, who you are, with your, if you're Bono, you're Michael, or you're, you know, I got, you know, some upcoming guys in town, that Zeely, this hip-hop guy, is just
love
taken
him.
Off. I mean, I did a couple songs for his EP. And,
oh, did
and,
you? Where do you, how do you, how much hip-hop stuff have you done?
I'm a huge hip-hop fan for some reason, being, you know, white boy Icelandic kid here. I've always wanted to do some, and I saw him play. I was, you know, I was watching AOL Nation and heard about him, and so he came up and blew me away one night, and I saw him a couple of times, and I thought he was amazing, so I wanted to work with him, and so it was my first real opportunity to do hip-hop, so I've co-wrote and produced a few songs with him, and I just love it. It's so much fun.
On the co-writing, what is it? Do you create the beats, and you make the bed underneath of what he's doing?
Yeah, I just create the song, and then I help him with, you know, for the thing with Zeelys, he had the hip-hop, he had the rap thing just going. I mean, the guy's an incredible rapper, but I just felt he didn't really have the songs, you know, he didn't have the hooks, that was my thing, just to do songs with him.
So you wrote hooks?
Yeah, well, Ern helped him. I mean, we do them together.
Hooks,
you know, it's like,
and you get people to
and get him to
sing
sort of sing.
Or,
no,
oh,
get,
yeah.
get him to sing. Yeah, I wanted to. You know, I didn't want to have this where he's only a rapper and he brings in people to sing the chorus. I wanted it to be him. You know, so I made him sing. So we'd come up with these cool sort of hooks and melodies, and I should give you a track or two. Two of my songs are on his new EP, and but that was my goal for him, is just do songs, get him singing, so it's not someone else. He's not relying on anybody but him.
Yeah. He's on a big tour right now, right?
Yeah, with AWOL Nation and the Imagine Dragons. Yeah,
okay.
Huge. He's playing for sold-out shows every night right now. It's amazing.
That's great.
Yeah.
What about, did you do any pop? Have you done, what about with like dance stuff? Is there dudes, they do that themselves? Are they kind of their own people?
A little. I mean, I just actually did some Disney stuff recently with this girl.
How was that?
AJ and Ellie. AJ and Ellie. There were some Disney stars from a few years back, and this girl AJ's doing a, this movie thing. I did some music for her recently. That was a lot of fun. I mean, that's one of the things too. I just do at my house. I can just kind of put the tracks together like that. And that stuff to me right now, that's kind of what I'm sort of going into a bit more is trying. I never really had maybe, I don't know if it was the confidence or what to get in the songwriting side, but the last while I've just decided, you know what? I can do this. I know I have good ideas. I'm always feeling stuff. And back in the day when I tried to write, it always seemed to be like sappy country songs or something. But I think just something's finally happened to me where I'm like feeling good about writing. And so I've been doing co-writes and writing with other people now. And that's kind of the direction I'm sort of trying to push into. Again, just that one-stop shop. Just, you know, help you write the song, produce, engineer, mix. You know, let's just make this happen and keep it on the down low with budgets and less people involved and make shit happen.
You know? Yeah. What are you working on now?
Well, I've got another, I think, is going to be the smash for Zeely. That's nearly done. I've been having a hard time finishing this one song, but it's a great one. Doing some stuff with Bob Schneider right now, a couple sort of mixes and stuff. Remix stuff.
I just had him on. He was telling me that he just finished recording a record.
Yeah, so they just sent me to a couple songs to do kind of like radio remix kind of thing.
Yeah.
And, I just finished this Disney thing. Alien Ant Farm, I just did a co-write with them a while ago. Sounds like it's going to be on the new record. I haven't talked to them recently, and they just got back together, original members, new deal, new everything. They're about to explode soon.
Cool.
What else am I doing? I got so, you know, I just lately, just rolling. this, that. You know, I get calls every day for things, you know.
So do you listen to any pop music? Like what?
I listen to everything, man.
Where do you stand on something like Carly Rae Jepsen?
I love it. Maybe. It's a great song. You know, I tell my kid, you know, she's 10. She just loves hip hop and pop. It's like, please, honey, don't tell anyone, but I really like this song. But to me, it's all about that feeling and emotion. I mean, I don't care if you're Carly Rae or who you are. If you can convey an emotion and make people want to move and feel sing, I don't care what genre or whatever. I'd like good songs. You know, and a lot of people bag on this pop or that. Disposable this, well, whatever.
People get mad at me for liking pop. And it's weird. It's even funnier because it's guys in Skyrocket that right back where we started from is the Call Me Maybe of like 1975,
exactly.
Dude. Like, don't,
exactly.
You know, it's just because it's something that spoke to you at a certain time. If you heard this song now for the first time, you'd probably hate it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know what I mean?
And it's pop music because it's called popular music because people like it.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, you know, bands like Nickelback, and not that I think they're the best thing
Canadian
from Canada.
Bros.
Yeah, but obviously they're doing something right that people love.
What is the best thing from Canada? Triumph?
If you'd asked me when I was 15, I might have said Triumph. Yeah. Or
were you
Rush.
A Triumph fan?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
I'm Canadian. I had to be.
Yeah, yeah.
And Rush, I mean, you had to be into Rush. Back
Saga?
Then. A little, yeah.
There was one band that...
And of course, then you got your Neil Youngs and stuff like that.
Yeah.
Joni Mitchell. I mean, you got some great stuff.
Rick
Leonard
James.
Cohen.
Yeah, Leonard Cohen. Yeah. Are you going to go see him?
I've never seen him, actually.
I've never seen him. But he's on tour. I just saw when I went running the other day and I ran by Madison Square Garden. And I guess he's playing there.
Oh, wow.
Doesn't seem like a place he'd play.
Yeah, really? Jeez.
He's not very underground in New York.
No.
He's very above the ground.
Yeah, yeah.
What about the Grammys? You're a governor for the...
I'm a governor for the Texas chapter. It's just a great organization. I mean, if you're in the music business, I think you just kind of have to be a part of it. I mean, it's literally everyone in it is professional music people.
And it's good networking, and you kind of get to kind of shape some stuff, don't you? You get to kind of create opportunities for people.
Oh, yeah.
Or
yeah, I mean, there's so much that happens behind the scenes that people don't even know.
Give us, like there's 18 of us sitting here. Me and all my personalities would like to know what is your job entail there as governor?
Well, it's really just about, like you said, helping shape different things. I mean, you know, we're part of a bigger thing with there's so much that goes on, advocacy, charity.
How many chapters are there?
12.
Okay, yeah, right. I had this conversation with Eric Jarvis.
Yeah, and we're Texas's, I believe, Mexico, New Mexico, Oklahoma, and Texas, I believe, is our chapter. And,
oh, wow.
But, you know, it's again, like there's a thing right now with the Grammy, with the credits. I can't remember the exact name of it, but they're trying to get... where all digital music now is kind of connected with the credits. Like somehow when you get on any MP3, it's kind of embedded in or encoded who mixed it, who recorded it, who wrote it, you know, so people know again. Because nobody knows who does anything anymore. Yeah. And to me, I mean, whatever, money comes and goes, but credits last forever. I mean, credits is where I've gotten half my career is just someone sees what you worked on this, they like it, and they call you. I mean, you know, money goes. I mean, credits are forever, you know, literally. So it's really sad that, you know, I do stuff and people have no idea sometimes, you know? So it's a great thing the Grammys are trying to just, again, just help this cause. And things like Music Cares, helping, you know, down and out musicians who might have troubles financially or medically or you know, drug abuse, whatever. I mean, just helping people. I mean, and anyone. I mean, you don't have to be a rock star to do it. I mean, you can just, any musician here in Austin having troubles or with, I mean, it could be they just
I bet a lot of people don't know that.
No.
I bet a lot of musicians don't know that.
You know, there could be some guy on Sixth Street right now has a tooth that's, you know, aching and he can't afford to go get it out. I mean, he could probably go to Music Cares and, hey, I'm a guy playing every night on Sixth Street and they'll help him out, you know? Or
what do you have to like fill out of, what do you go to, like the Grammy,
Grammy.com, and then Music Cares is a program, and there's every year they do big charity events in Los Angeles during Grammy times to fund it. And I mean, at our last governor meeting, there was someone who came in and talked about it. And again, I think you're right, as a lot of people don't know about it. I mean, you have to be, you know, working musician, like, I mean, again, not a rock star, but just
that's how you make your money.
Or to a degree, at least. I mean, obviously no one's rich on Sixth Street, whatever, but you have to be actually a musician, but they'll, I mean, I've seen the numbers. I mean, they do a lot of help, and they'll, it's all real discreet too, though. So I only know so much as well, but, I mean,
it's real discreet as that they don't put like poster boys like, you know, this guy doesn't have enough money to get his arm fixed.
Exactly. Yeah. Like they only tell us even so much, you know, they'll give us numbers and how many people or this and that, what, you know, but they don't really tell you anything else than that, you know.
What, anything else? Like a lot of functions? Do you make any decisions about anything?
Some stuff I'm not allowed to talk about.
Really? Oh, that's pretty cool.
Well, there's things.
I mean, you don't have to talk about it, but it's cool that you've got some top secret information up there.
And then also, you know, being a Grammy member, you get to vote for the Grammys.
Yeah.
You know, if you're a voting member, which anyone with like 7 credits can be a voting member. And so you basically can vote. Yeah. You should become a member.
Yeah.
Tell them I sent you.
I could change the... My vote could count.
It can. I mean, there's literally, 12,000 voting members, so.
Oh, in Canada?
No. Of the states?
Of
recording camp.
Really?
Yeah.
Do you get free records, like you get free movies when you're in the Academy of Movie People?
On the things that I can't talk about, yeah.
That's awesome. Part of this podcast, I kind of wanted to have free music and people to let me in their shows for free. Isn't that small-minded?
Why do you think I'd do what I do?
Yeah.
I mean, come on.
It's like that thing in Almost Famous when
which I saw last night.
Hoffman. You did. Philip Seymour Hoffman is Lester Bangs, and he's like that. This is the first thing. You get free records. Why not make your life into a thing where you get free records?
Yeah. Oh yeah. I feel bad actually. Just the other day, I had a friend say, "Hey, do you want to go to the show tomorrow night?" And I'm like, "Yeah, well, let me see. I'll make some calls, see if I can get some tickets." I'm just like, and I kind of said, "Well, don't, this sounds really bad, but I kind of, you know, always seem to get in for free to all these shows." But I mean, I go to so many shows.
Pay and buy music and stuff.
Well, I always buy music. Yeah. Always. Yeah. I don't even know how you steal music. I will never do that. But shows, I mean, I know a lot of people. People just get me on guest lists and, you know.
That's funny that you say that, because I have refused to learn how to work BitTorrent. I downloaded once a record and I felt really bad.
Yeah.
Worse than I have when I've lied to someone about something.
Totally. Yeah. No, I will never, ever, never. I don't even know. I've never been to LimeWire. I've never been, you know, there's no way. I'll buy any music. I mean, that's out of my, you know, everyone talks, you know, mass public, rock stars, you know, do they really need more money? You know, blah, blah, blah. It's like, well, no, it's not the rock stars. It's guys like me. You know, it's guys like me taking care of my kid who would lose money.
Yeah.
You know, my royalties are pretty much non-existent.
People wouldn't be able to afford, your royalties would be non-existent. Also, people wouldn't be able to afford to go make a record with somebody like you because they didn't sell any of their last one because everyone stole it.
Yeah. I mean, it's money out of guys like me that, you know, it's not the rock stars losing money. Obviously, they make their money with shows and whatnot. They, you know, bands have never really made a whole lot of money from record sales ever. I mean, just the way the major label system is set up,
right?
You know, so that's not, it's not a, I mean, obviously, they should get their due. I mean, you create something, it's yours. I mean, you should get your thing, but it's the studio owners, it's the producers, the engineers and mixers, the side musicians who are the ones losing in all this music stealing, you know?
Yeah. So, anybody that you ever wanted to work with that you, I mean, just one person?
Jeez.
Just one person. You're like, I've always wanted to just work with this one person once, or band.
Man, I mean, I've been pretty lucky. I've gotten to work with
a lot of cool people.
I love Coldplay. I mean, I like them. Geez.
So did you get to meet Eno and stuff when you were working with
him? Oh, yeah. I mean, we're working for a couple months. I mean, we all eat together. We all hang, you know. I mean, Brian Eno actually is probably the smartest person I've ever met in my life.
He seems like that. Like, but this is my problem, is I feel like he really realizes it.
Well, yeah. But I mean, like, I'd be sitting for, you know, we used to hang out a lot, like at dinner or lunch or whatever. And I remember, I mean, it'd be things like, CJ, I was listening to my German philosophy radio station this morning, the 1900 classic German philosophers, and they were telling this, and I'm just kind of like, oh, really? And I have no idea. What it is. Yeah. CJ, have I ever told you I'm in this foundation that is trying to, like, that? CJ, do you know how many languages there are in this world? I'm in a foundation to protect all the languages, and CJ, I was thinking about the British Palestine uprising of the 1900s this morning, and, you know, I'm just like, really, Brian?
That's exactly what I think.
I mean, he's amazing. I mean, literally, I mean, the guy's the smartest guy I've ever known in my life, and I feel so stupid around him. You know, yeah.
I read this interview years ago in Tape Op with Lenoir. Maybe it was with, you know, I think it might have been with Lenoir. How they mixed those records, how they would have two different rooms off of the main studio with their own little whatever, like Mackie boards or something, and they would do their mixes and then kind of compare the two and then take the best of the both. And it must, for a guy that you would assume from reading these kind of articles or reading his book that maybe he has a giant ego, to have that kind of be able to put aside his there's guys that have, you know, pretty big egos that work in this business, that to go like, oh, well, your drum sound on this is better than mine. Let's use that one, and we'll try this sound that I did. You know what I mean? Right. Well, it was pretty impressive.
Well, that's the unique thing with them working with you, too. You know, Brian Eno and Danny Lanois and Steve Lillywhite is, you know, Brian's...
It's been forever they've all worked together.
I mean, Brian's all about that. He's just... Brian will just throw this and that and just do so much creativity on the tracks, just all the stuff. And then Danny's the vibe guy. Danny's will keep it kind of real and cool and add that part to it. And then they get Lillywhite in there to kind of sort through it all and make something out of it, kind of thing. I mean, it's a real, just amazing little thing how they do it together. I mean,
it's amazing. And you're part of that team. Or you were part of that team.
I mean, believe me, I'm the luckiest guy in the world. I mean, you know, it's incredible. Because there's a lot of great people in this world who do great things. And somehow I just got, you know, I don't know, I got lucky. You know?
Yeah.
So I'm definitely, you know, happy about that.
That's good. Yeah. What? I'm drawing a blank. What's the English dude? I interviewed him. Why am I drawing a blank? He mixes too. He did U2.
Tim Palmer.
Yeah. Same. That's exactly what he said. Yeah. Feels like the luckiest guy in the world.
Yeah. I mean, obviously to be in a business, I mean, to, again, for me, since age five, the music is all I want. And here I am, you know, in my early 40s and still doing it and still somehow surviving. I'm so lucky. I mean, how many people in their life get to just do what they love to do? I mean, I think everyone should be able to, but you know, obviously I've worked my ass off and but there's a lot of luck and a lot of right place at the right time involved as well, you know? So, I mean, I'm just, again, just so fortunate.
Yeah. And you're a nice guy. I like you.
I'm trying. Yeah. Canadians, you know, we're...
Yeah. You're known for it. Yeah. Was there anything that I'm missing? That was it.
I think we covered everything.
Everything? Have you ever witnessed a physical fight in the studio? This is the last question.
Okay. Man, did he pass away? Dan Hicks, remember Dan Hicks?
Yeah.
Did I read that he passed away or is he still alive? I'm really horrible that I'm saying that. But anyways, I did a record with him years ago.
If he hears this, he's going to be pissed.
No, he probably is. But he had this temper. Like he would get angry. And I can remember this one time, it wasn't really a fight per se, but he was in this small little booth. Like it was, I mean, literally, vocal booth. I mean, you just barely had enough room to hold his guitar and move. Yeah. I mean, it's literally just right around him. And I remember once something bugged him with the, you know, I was working with this producer guy that, and he said something, and Dan would just sort of, something set him off. And I can remember him just, you know, you could see him getting angry and angry because there had been a few outbursts already, but this one in particular. Right. And next thing you know, he just starts, and he goes into this rage and he's swinging his guitar and his mic and like the mic and the cables, he was getting caught like a fish in a net, you know, he's just twisting around and cables are wrapped and mic's hitting and in this little booth and the producer's like, Dan, it's okay, calm down, Dan, it's cool. And he's just, I want to kill you. He's just, I'm going to kill you. But he can't move because he's wrapped in cables and microphones and he's an old guy. I mean, he's like 60 something.
Oh, wow.
Old, tall, big. I mean, it was like frightening, but also hilarious. I mean, I was just like laughing, but scared. You know, it was pretty, I remember that. It was pretty hilarious. Well, you know, we're finally like, it's okay. It's okay. Yeah. Calm down. But just seeing how he just got so caught up. I mean, mean, not really fight, but that just kind of came to my mind as a pretty hilarious thing.
Are your parents proud?
I think so.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah. And your daughter, she's like, you turn her on to music every once in a while? Or is she at the age where like, no, Dad, you don't understand?
Well, if it's hip-hop, she likes it.
Yeah.
And, but she's actually my, because she's got this weird sense of music, too. She's definitely got the music gene. She knows, she'll remember lyrics. She'll remember, she'll hear a song once, and it'll come on, and she'll remember exactly. I mean, she knows how, she'll explain the styles of different rappers and stuff. And
oh, wow.
She's really like that. And she actually, on one of my Zeely tracks, Womp, if you listen in the intro and then throughout the song, there's this little, this little kind of humming hook, and that's her. She,
oh, wow.
I was working on the track one day, and she comes in. She's like, "Dad, can I have a track? Can you can I have the mic?"
Yeah.
Like, yeah, of course. Yeah. And I give her the mic, and she just starts singing this little melody, and I was just blown away. And I kind of manipulated, a little distorted, just made it kind of cool. And then I had three tracks I sent to Zeely like shortly after, and that was the first thing he caught on. He's like, I'm like, so what do you think of the tracks? He's like, oh, I love them. There's this one song. There's a sound there. I love it. I don't know what it is, but I love this sound. And that was, you know, my kid's thing. So I definitely use her as like a, you know, what do you think of the song? You like this song? Yeah, you like this? And because she's really super knowledgeable. It's amazing.
How do people find you if they need to? Do you have a website?
I'm so easy to find.
CJ Erickson, you're on Facebook.
Oh, well, I have CJ Erickson. I barely use it, but I mean, you can reach me. Then my management, World's End Producer, worldsend.com is
okay.
My manager, World's End Producer Management. And I'm pretty easy to find. I'm out there. I'm out and about. I'm easy to get to, for sure.
If you're not in Dublin,
yeah.
Extended periods of time.
We'll see.
Well, thank you so much for coming by.
Thank
CJ.
You.
CJ, you're a nice guy, and I
love
your
work.
Hope
I didn't talk too much here.
Alejandro Escovedo said that when I had to stop because there was a guy sawing upstairs on his interview. He's like, "You're not talking to me." It's like, it would be really bad if you didn't. Well, thank you, man. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Little Matchbox 20. All right, CJ Erickson, man. What a great guy. I really like him. I'm going to stay in touch and hang out. I'm going to see if I can get him to do some stuff with me. I'm going to send him some music. That's what I'm going to do. Hey, everyone, thank you so much for listening. Thank you to CJ for finally, man, it was a long time we were trying to get that together. I would say since March. So I want to thank him for coming by. It was great getting to hang out and talk to him and hear about his life and the work he's done. You know, if you're a musician out there, he's available. Guys like that, you know, you can find them. And have them work with you. So everyone, I want to thank you for listening once again. I want to encourage you to follow me on Twitter, like our Facebook page. Have picture. I didn't take a picture with CJ. God. Anyway, subscribe to us on iTunes. And I love you. Thank you for listening. Here's a little Michael McDermott. That's who he was talking about. He was happy about doing that record. So here's a song from him. And thank you so much for listening again. Bye-bye.
been wound up a little too tight. I hit the bottle so hard, in fact, that this morning it hit me back. I hit the bottle pretty hard last night. I've been wound.